Support for today's Wolf Den comes from Shutterstock. Every business needs high-quality images, right, to attract and to keep customers. Well, whether you're making brochures or ads or putting the final touches to your next tweet, I spend hours doing that, the visuals you choose are proven to make a big difference. So you can get started today with Shutterstock. They're offering you a 20% discount at shutterstock.com/wolfden. That's shutterstock.com/wolfden. You probably know about How Did This Get Made? It's one of my favorite shows here at Earwolf. Paul Scheer, June Diane Raphael, and Jason Manzoukas, they watch movies that are, I think this is the actual quote, so bad they're actually amazing, and discuss them with some of their funniest friends. They have a huge new episode that I know you won't want to miss. It's with Abby Jacobson and Ilana Glazer. They're the creators and stars of Broad City, and they join the gang live at Clusterfest to watch a truly terrible movie called Ninja Terminator. The worst movies make the best How Did This Get Made, of course, and Ninja Terminator makes Waterworld look like a masterpiece. It's apparently one of the most shockingly bad films ever made, and I know that the How Did This Get Made crew will tear it to pieces in a most delightful way. So you should tune out. Not tune out. You should tune in. Don't ever tune out. Just tune in. So check out Abby and Ilana on How Did This Get Made and subscribe to the podcast so you'll never miss an episode. Hello and welcome to The Wolf Den. This is the podcast about the business and the people of podcasting. I'm Chris Bannon. My co-host Lex Friedman is away on his luxury yacht, the Dad Role, this week. He'll be back sometime in the future. But today, our guest is Aaron Lammer. He is the co-founder and CTO of Longform.org and the host of a new podcast called Stoner. And we'll get to him in just a second. But first, I will preserve the tradition I started with Lex and talk about a show I'm jealous of. This is from Roman Mars. It's a show called What Trump Can Teach Us About Con Law, Constitutional Law. It's a relatively new show. I think there are only three episodes out. And it features a UC Davis law professor, Elizabeth Joe, who simply takes apart things Trump might do and explores what constitutionally a president is allowed to do and what precedents have been set by other presidents. It's actually a really fascinating history lesson. That also, I think one reason why it succeeds for me is that it follows a personal obsession of Roman. And I find that when a host really cares about something, that's when you get podcast gold. So that's my pick. And Aaron, before I introduce you, tell me, what show are you jealous of?
Well, I was thinking about this from the opposite perspective, not being jealous of it for like what it's like to listen to, but the actual experience of the hosts of the show. And I'm going to pick How Did This Get Made, which I believe is a Earwolf show.
It is an Earwolf show.
And the reason I pick that, well, it's a fantastic show. It's probably the only show I'm like a completist for. But it just seems like a lot of fun to like pick a terrible movie with some of your friends and then watch it and hang out and talk about it. Like, that probably happens to me like twice a year just through serendipity.
Yeah.
And if I could just pre-schedule like people I know who I like to talk about movies with, that would be the most enjoyable for me. So that's the one I'm the most envious
Have you listened to the episode about the Star Wars Christmas special?
Oh, yes, I have.
Okay. That's one of my favorite episodes of that show. But it's you should see it live. Have you seen it live?
I have never seen it live.
It is a fantastic live experience. And I think you're right. It's a show in which everyone is clearly there and having a good time, and they want to be there, and you can hear it. And they have relationships that matter with each other, too. Thank you for choosing that. I'll pass that on to Paul Scheer. we'll comp you a seat at the next live show in New York.
If there's any way I can become a How Did This Get Made insider, that's where I'm angling here.
Harry, get this man a t-shirt after this interview is over. Aaron Lammer is the co-founder of Longform.org. He's the co-host of the Longform podcast, as well as a successful musician, part of the band Francis and the Lights. Is that right? And his newest podcast is called Stoner. And on it, creative people talk about their experiences with marijuana, among other things. They talk about a lot of things, but that's one.
We'll keep it open-ended.
Okay. I like that about a show. So tell me first, how do you think of yourself? You have so many different roles that you play. Are you a journalist first, a musician first, a writer first, a technology guy, an entrepreneur?
I'm definitely not a journalist first. I mean, I've never really done any journalism. Almost all of these projects are projects that I happened into with friends, really. Mm-hmm. And I'd say that's the connecting tissue here, is I like to do projects. I believe in just kind of going for it and like seeing what happens.
Yeah.
And all of the things you've cited are basically projects that have started off as, I'm just going to try this, and have gone somewhere. Stoner's the newest one, so it's only, we're only a few months in.
Right.
But that's how Max and I started Longform. Max has been on the show. He now runs Pineapple also, Max Linsky.
Yep.
And Francis and the Lights, which I write songs for. I don't like tour as part of the band anymore, or I ever did really, but I like to write songs with my friend Francis, and he's someone I went to elementary school on with,
mm-hmm.
and we just started doing this when we were young. So it's fortunate that I'm able to do this stuff as like sort of a career.
So your approach to life is probably the same as your approach to your career. You're going to say, why not? Let's try it.
Yeah, and I'm also interested in the business parts of this. Like, we didn't just try to make Longform a cool website. When it got an audience, a lot of the learning process has been, how do you get sponsors? How do mm-hmm. you do, you know, a lot of the stuff that goes into making a podcast. I think I'm excited by the sort of small level entrepreneurial mm-hmm. elements of it. And I'd like to do more of that, actually.
Yeah. Can we start with what Longform really means? Because
yes.
I think it's an insider term a little bit.
It certainly is, yes. And it's become slightly maligned, which I think is a positive statement about our impact, that people have heard it enough that they've gotten annoyed now. but when we started Longform, I mean, you know, another word for it would be sort of feature magazine journalism.
Right.
The kind of articles that you really need to sit down and take 15 or 20 minutes with. When we started the site, part of the purpose was that people were getting all these e-readers in their pockets, and you're mm-hmm. on a commute, you know, you need to keep a certain amount of stuff to read going. And we were sort of passing around articles, and we ended up building a website that was kind of a curated, different editors reading them. And
it's a recommendation.
Yeah, it's a recommendation.
Really, right?
It's yeah. really pretty
simple.
You're
not doing a lot of original journalism.
No, we're not
right?
doing really any. I mean, we do like reprints occasionally of articles that aren't online. We try to cover the whole history of the forum. So, you know, we have articles from the 1800s up to today. And it's kind of just a place to go and find your reading. And we've built other things off of it. We had an app that would allow you to do a lot of this stuff directly on your phone and sort of follow authors and publishers. We ended up pulling that because apps are not a great business to be in,
mm-hmm.
in case anyone's shocked to learn that one now. But we have a really successful podcast now in which we talk to a lot of the writers who write these articles.
What makes an article worth pulling from the 1877 New York Times and putting on Longform?
Well, I mean, I think it's interesting to see how long a lot of these things like true crime reporting have existed and what form they took before. And, you know, you can kind of have this weird feeling that, oh, we just sort of invented the modern world from 1970 on.
Yeah.
And actually, like, a lot of these forms of reporting are largely unchanged. I mean, I would say actually one of the strangest parts about doing long form is realizing that this format has existed for the better part of a century and is pretty similar. You know, a magazine feature around 5,000 words.
Right.
That's a thing that existed a long time ago.
And how many pages is 5,000 words?
It's like a New Yorker story. I don't know. It's like maybe 8 or 10 pages. Mm-hmm. 20, 25.
So
minute read.
One sitting experience.
Yeah,
basically.
One sitting experience. But one that you wouldn't browse through on your phone while you're in line, probably.
And have you found, whether it's on the app or on the website, that users actually, your vision of what you thought people wanted, did it actually come to fruition? Did the thing you thought you were building turn out to be the thing you built?
Yeah, mostly yes. But what people actually read is not necessarily like what they share on Twitter. So, you know.
Give me an example.
Well, you know, you could look at it as sort of a high-minded enterprise, but if you look in the analytics and you look at the most clicked every year, it's sex and crime. Often sex crime.
Right.
Yes, are
if
those
we can get those two together,
yes,
that's gold right
that's,
there.
I mean, that's what really people want to read.
Yeah.
So as much as people may tell you that they want to read about international politics or human interest stories, there's a reason why like true crime dominates podcasts and mm-hmm. all of these things. There are certain like things that keep popular over time,
right?
In terms of what people actually pick.
And is it because we can't help ourselves? Like, it's like seeing a car accident or something. These stories just move us in some way we can't describe. Or do you think there's something about, for instance, true crime in audio that makes it especially great?
I think that sometimes in nonfiction, it's hard to establish stakes when you write a story about climate change, the stakes are actually enormous, but they don't feel huge.
Right.
I think that true crime works particularly well as nonfiction as articles or podcasts because there's an enormous built-in stake. You're talking about human lives and capturing a killer and these things that are big. And I think that even when people choose a podcast over going to see a movie in a theater, they're still like yearning for some of the same dopamine hits, I think.
Right. So as a podcast producer yourself, when you think about the long-form show, do you worry about that? How do you give your listeners the dopamine? What is the dopamine in your show?
For me, what's the most important to get with a guest is I like to get into a place they've never been before and that is hopefully kind of raw and maybe a little emotionally naked and honest. So, nonfiction writers don't necessarily have to write about themselves.
Right.
But they experience things that are pretty...
Only if they want a book deal.
Only if they want a book deal. But they're experiencing things that are pretty extraordinary. You know, we have war reporters on the show. We have people who report on murders. And it's really what I look for in a show is to get the listener like... firsthand into those experiences.
So we should describe the show a little bit. It's really interviews, in-depth, extensive interviews with working journalists from all different media, right?
If you listen to Marc Maron, like WTF, that was the show I listened to the most when I was before I did the show. Think of it as what Marc Maron is to comedians, we try to be with people who tell real-life stories.
That's a great elevator pitch, actually.
Yeah, and I wasn't sure when we did it. I was like, well, comedians are, you know, the real entertainers. They're going to, you know, well, these writers, are they going to be okay? And it's like, no, it works really well because they're storytellers. Mm-hmm. Like, almost everyone who comes on our show tells stories professionally. They're real stories, but they're really good at putting you in that experience.
Can you point to a couple of episodes where a guest reached that emotional moment that you were talking about a couple minutes ago?
I mean, I think my favorite interview that I've ever done on the show is with Rukmini Callimachi, who covers ISIS for the New York Times. And I think, you know, there's been several things done with her afterwards, so I'm taking credit for something that many people have talked to her about
right.
this, but I think at the time it was the first person. She's someone who is in daily contact with people in ISIS on chat apps.
Wow.
And has like real human relationships with them, many of whom have died while she's been in contact. So I think just talking to her about the sort of day-to-day experience of having this like chat group of ISIS fighters who occasionally disappear and are like, you know, trying to tell her various things. And on one level,
you're also possibly attacking her society at the same
absolutely.
Time.
Absolutely. And also, but she having this mundane relationship with them and that it's impossible to speak to someone over a period of years and not have some human empathy
right.
for them.
Right. Oh, that's astonishing. Do you remember when that episode came out for listeners who might want to go?
I'm going to say that was in 2014.
Okay.
I'll put it in the show notes.
Okay, great.
Do you do show notes?
Harry, do we do show notes? No. He's shaking his head. I'm afraid we don't do show
just
notes.
Just Google.
This is really bare bones.
Long show. Form Rukmini Callimachi. You'll find it. It's very easy to spell, obviously.
Okay, good. Yeah. Terrific. And do you feel like the show has evolved? I have some specific questions about how you make it, but has the show evolved over the years that you've been doing? It's now 3 years old?
Five years. Yeah, we're just crossed 250 episodes. Yeah, it has a lot. I mean, I think the biggest thing that we've changed is to really broaden the definition of who we'd want to have on the show. Originally, it was like people who worked for The New Yorker and The Atlantic and The New York Times, and we've started inviting on a lot of documentary filmmakers and podcasters. We had on Brian Reed from S-Town.
I heard that episode. That was
so one of my other ambitions for the show is for it to feel definitive. For someone like Brian Reed, who's made what I consider a masterpiece,
it is a masterpiece.
Of the form, who's not going to go out and give 500 interviews because I think it would detract from the mystery of the show, to give one really in-depth interview about how he made S-Town so that someone who's in journalism school right now who's thinking about going into this can say like, wow, like we got it.
We learned the story.
Yeah. And so when we have someone like that, we're really careful to think about it that way. It's not just, oh, tell me the craziest thing that happened. Like
right.
we want it to serve as sort of like a historical record of these kinds of productions that are going on now.
It's great to have that framework in mind when you start because then you know what you have to do in order to achieve that for the person listening, right?
Yeah.
You have a sort of mental roadmap of everything you have to lay down.
And the cool thing that's happened in the 5 years since we've been doing the show is that a lot of the people who were doing magazine journalism are now doing podcasts, doing documentary films, doing cross-media projects. So there's a lot more cross-pollination of different kinds of people doing different kinds of things, which just makes the show more exciting. Because it gets boring to be like, so how do you write a magazine profile? You hang out with a celebrity? Is it hard to get access? Like, yeah. I want to have people on the weirdest fringe, not the people who are doing the most by the books.
Vanity Fair cover article?
Yeah, we had on like Trisha Lockwood, who was like doing this kind of like weird Twitter poetry stuff that it's really good, and then just came out with a memoir. And so I want to have people like that.
And was there any really awkward moment that you really wish you could redo in all of these interviews? That any moment where you think, oh, I wish that hadn't happened?
Yeah. I'm not going to talk about the worst one because it's I don't want to rehash.
I think of Gene Simmons storming out of Fresh Air as one of those things that you are so glad you have the tape of, right?
But I'll tell you, well, the time I was the most worried while we were taping the podcast is we have a very tiny studio. It's maybe a
not as luxurious as this Earwolf studio.
It's like the if this Earwolf studio was a house and this was a closet inside that house.
Ooh.
So we've moved. We have a bigger studio now at Pineapple, but at the time we had it and it would get really hot in there. And we didn't have any kind of ventilation or anything. And we kind of, you know, when someone who's like a 27-year-old who's working at Gawker comes, it's like, oh, whatever. Like,
right.
You know, wear a t-shirt. We had Louis Lapham on.
Oh.
Louis Lapham, I don't know. I think he's probably around 80 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And he
was wearing a full suit?
He showed up in like a three-piece suit with a cravat. And Max was doing the interview and myself and Evan sat outside just like, oh, that's like, and Louis Lapham is going to die on our podcast in the studio.
Possibly melt into a Glenn Plaid puddle on
but
the floor.
But he was totally fine. He was completely unfazed by it. I guess if you wear a three-piece suit and a cravat, you just wear it in all situations.
Well, and I think he does. I've seen him at various things and he's always impeccably dressed. Let me ask you how you prepare for the show. Because a lot of our listeners are people who make podcasts and are always curious about that.
I think I'm an over-preparer probably, and I've learned to temper that a little bit. I like to – originally I would want to read almost every article that the person had ever written. And if they've written a book recently, I try to read a couple of the books. That becomes difficult as you know, scale that. I mean, I only do an episode every 3 weeks, so there is actually the potential to do some of that. But – what I do now, because I don't really read questions off, I like to basically get it in my head and try and sort of memorize it, is like I really like power like the last 2 hours before the interview and just like inhale as much stuff as I can of the person. I read their Wikipedia page. I read interviews with them. And it kind of gets me in a state where I'm like, I got some ideas. I got some energy. And then let's just see what happens. Because I don't know what course an interview is going to take. It could go in very different directions. Some of our interviews are very autobiographical. Some of our interviews are very like procedural, like how you do a very specific thing. So I try to stay open to it by not preparing a distinct course.
Do you have any sort of tricks that you use in interviews? An interviewer once told me that he waited until the last 3 or 4 minutes of an interview. This was in radio, so there was an actual clock where they would go off the air, and then he would ask one really hard question.
I look at the last 20 minutes. Like I can sometimes feel it ending. Like I'm like, okay, I could draw it to a close. This probably drives our editor crazy. And I'm like, we could just stop now and we'd have the episode. So I feel like I have this extra bonus round where I could just like kind of take some shots and it's like maybe something great will happen. And if it's a failure, we can just cut it out. And I try to use that. I don't so much wait for like an off question as I kind of like wait to just start like taking the conversation in whatever weird direction it's kind of going in and almost feeling like we've gotten amazing stuff before interviews start and like right after they
end. You should always be rolling.
Always be rolling. So I kind of like try to engineer for an end section that it's sort of unclear whether it's like rolling or unclear whether we're kind of done or not. I'll kind of say like, yeah, that's my last question. And then I'll just start asking follow-up questions and keep talking and see what happens. That's my trick.
That's the beauty of podcasting, right? We don't have those formats and clocks to worry about, so it's fine.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, I want to get people in that casual, loose state. You know, I want to get that feeling. Right when they were walked in is a great feeling, and when they've been completely worn down by talking for like an hour, that's right. Also a great feeling.
It probably helps that it's 100 degrees in your studio.
Yes,
too.
Of course, and they're also deeply dehydrated.
Yeah, you don't give them water. That's good. Did we give you water?
I just took some without even asking.
I think that could be from a Comedy Bang Bang session. We'll see.
I hope it's like actually water.
If you come down with something, give me a call. The podcast is very, very successful. Is it driving the business that you do now in some serious way?
It does very much. I mean, it's probably our central revenue stream, and long form's a small project that's worked on by two or three people. And, you know, we earn enough by here and there with little sponsorships, and mm-hmm. the biggest ones are the podcast. It's the easiest to sell, and I think it drives the biggest consistent audience, at least, you know, viewed in sort of advertising value.
So you sell ads for the podcast, and then those buyers also get space on the website?
Often, yeah. I mean, yeah. If one comes in through one door, we'll try to sell them. We'll try to ask them to do the whole thing. And some people just want to be part of the podcast. Some people just want to be part of the site. But mostly we're just trying to say, like, let's pick a reasonable number and, like, let's put your brand across these.
Right.
And I think podcast is really driving that right now.
I mean, you can hear your enthusiasm for the show and the way that you guys relate to each other and in your interest in the people that you choose to talk to. On the website, how do you keep it interesting for yourself? Because otherwise it could become, oh, let's just put this up today. Let's just, you know, and it becomes a routine and not a passion.
We have a team of people that read stories and pick them, and we kind of oversee that team, and that team is really passionate, and we're able to sort of put new people in and out of that team to kind of keep it fresh. So yes, if Max and I were picking all the stories every day, I don't think that it would work exactly the same, but mm-hmm. there's we sort of distribute it, and Max actually does the most work on it, and he still is somehow able to be passionate about it. But
he seems to have a bottomless supply of enthusiasm.
He's a very enthusiastic man, and I focused, you know, previously a lot more on our product and sort of tech concerns, which aren't really as much of an issue now because we don't have this app, which was probably more than 50% of our resources.
Yeah, tell me the story of the app. What happened with the app?
We built what I think is a really incredible app that I think did inspire things like Apple's Apple News and stuff like that. I mean, I think...
How long did it take you to build it? How much energy went into it?
Took two full years of like me and a developer working on it to get it kind of up to the point where it was on the iPhone and the iPad, and it was...
And you charged people for it, or was it free?
We made it free eventually. I mean, this is the weird thing about scale. It's sort of like podcasts. It's like, do you think you can have a successful podcast that charges money? Haven't seen it yet.
Well, WTF, Never Not Funny.
But the new episodes are
right.
Free. So, yes, we could have probably done some sort of an upgrade scheme, but kind of the direction Apple was going, like pretty much out of the jump, was like, don't charge people money or at least create a free experience. And we could never find
it's
a really...
It's great that Apple wants other people not to charge money for things.
We were charging for it originally, and we made money on it when it first came out, but then we were sort of chasing a scale where it's like the most fun stuff to work on is stuff that hundreds of thousands of people are listening to and using. Like, that's what excites me about podcasting, and I don't really want to be making niche products and then begging people to pay me $4.99 for which they want lifetime service and stuff like that. It's still not even a great deal at the paid level. So I'm really proud of what we built, but it just wasn't sustainable when we had really a full-time developer working on it.
Did you imagine that it would be a kind of cash stream for you when you decided to go ahead with it?
Well, this was the period of like startup mania where you could kind of raise money for anything. Mm-hmm. And I thought that we would build a prototype and then we'd raise money and we'd become like a big company. What I realized afterwards was that the companies that were ahead of us doing similar stuff were all like about to like run out of money themselves and that we could have achieved 10 times the success and it still wouldn't have really moved the needle for a venture investor.
Yeah.
So it was a real learning experience, and you know, I try to be open about it because maybe someone is listening and they're thinking about something similar, which is you can have a really successful personal they call them a lifestyle business, and you can go and chase money and chase investors, but it's a big distraction from the basic thing. And where we've ultimately ended up is doing what we do cheap and trying to grow it and trying to get sponsors who believe in what we're doing. And it's a more direct relationship that way.
And you, do you yourself look for sponsors? Do you do some of that work?
I do. Yeah. I'd say it's mostly Max. Max is, mm-hmm. is really, but I'm starting to have to do more now that I'm doing Stoner, which is my own project. Yeah. And that's a really like unusual sponsor market also, because all the businesses,
questions about that.
All the businesses are locked to a single state. So it's not an easy one. In some ways with that project, I'm really gambling on national legalization to open up the sponsorship market. And I'm building a product that I think could succeed in 2 or 3 years if things go a certain way.
I want to ask you about Stoner after our break, but I have one more question before we go into the break. Do you have a philosophy or a feeling about the ways in which a medium or a platform can influence the content that you make? In other words, making an app or having this website, how does the shape of it affect what you end up putting out there?
Well, I think one of the reasons I like I was kind of a podcast skeptic. Like Max got me into podcast stuff. I was not like
When was this?
More than 5 years ago, six years ago, we started thinking about it and working on it. And, you know, at the time, I thought, well, I want to do big, like, scalable things, like millions of people use apps and podcasts. It's like you're doing well if you hit 10,000. Five, six figures here, you know. But I like the container. I like the simplicity of the podcast container, because you kind of have to – you kind of have to fit what you're doing inside it. And that's why for Stoner, I had thought about building a whole kind of like a vertical, like around the thing, like, oh, I'll get writers and all this stuff. And I was like, what if I could try and fit all the ideas from that in this like little box here, instead of trying to do something sprawling where I'm going to need like designers and I'm going to need, and that's all stuff I know how to do. Like I know how to build WordPress sites and I'm a decent designer. I like design all the app stuff, but I just sort of know about the limitations of a single person, and I like things where I can that are constrained enough that I can control a lot of the things inside them.
Right. How do you feel that podcasts have changed journalism or long form journalism?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, I think a lot of people are saying, "Wow, if I could make a great podcast out of this story, it could get a much bigger audience or be much more noticed than it would be if I published in a magazine." Mm-hmm.
You hear journalists say that?
That does seem to be an idea in the air that, you know, well, what if you have a really good idea for a podcast? I think it hasn't really happened yet. I think people are thinking about it. Like, I think a lot of people who are print people have a really good idea right now, or think they have a really good idea right now.
Yes.
We'll see if they actually do. Like, I think it's not probably as easy to make that jump or to make this stuff. And we'll also see what happens in the market if it gets flooded with a magazine writer is trying to make podcasts,
right?
You know, which maybe it already is. I don't know.
I think there are many of them out there trying. I totally agree with you that it's a very tempting thing. And part of it is that I think the class of people who write and edit those kinds of stories for print also all listen to audio, and they started as public radio listeners, and now they've got this podcast universe, and it's very tempting to sit there and ask yourself, well, why not me?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I try to think about podcasting primarily from the like making my own show perspective. I don't pay like a ton of attention to – I don't listen to a ton of stuff.
And I was going to ask you, what's on your listening?
I'm like – my listening is very different than what I make. I mean, like I'm like every Bill Simmons show.
That's great.
How did this get made every episode? I listen to stuff that I think is like great and entertaining, but I don't necessarily listen to stuff that's super similar to anything that I do. And – I try to make all of this stuff sort of designed for myself as a listener. So it's not like I don't get concerned when I thought about looking at Stoner. It's like there's like Canna News podcast. I'm not like, oh, I don't know if I should do that. There's Canna News out there.
Yeah.
I think about more about myself as a listener, and I'm like, is there a show that appeals to me as a listener out there? Not really. Then I feel like there's an opening.
Great. Well, we're going to hear more about that after this break. I'm talking to Aaron Lammer from longform.org and the Longform Podcast, and this is The Wolf Den. This episode is sponsored by the book Podcast Advertising Works: How to Turn Engaged Audiences into Loyal Customers. It was written by Glenn Rubenstein from the podcast ad agency Adopter Media. Glenn has worked in podcast advertising for over 5 years now, and he's taken that experience and written a guide for both podcasters and podcast advertisers. The book explains everything from how podcast advertising rates are calculated to breaking down what makes for an effective podcast ad. And it also gives you a history of the medium, and it talks about the medium's evolution to where it is today. And I believe my colleague Lex Friedman is even thanked in the dedication, which is why I'm probably reading this spot. It has great reviews, and the ebook version is on sale for 99 cents. Buy it on Amazon or on iTunes. That's Podcast Advertising Works, How to Turn Engaged Audiences into Loyal Customers. It's by Glenn Rubenstein. It comes from Adopter Media. And I am excited to announce the launch of Stitcher Premium. It's the new subscription service that brings all your favorite free and premium podcasts together under one deluxe roof. With Stitcher Premium, you get access to the same exciting content as you might have had if you were a subscriber to Howl, more than 250 hours of exclusive original shows, ad-free archives, and bonus episodes of some of your favorite podcasts, including, and this is important, Wolf Den listeners, including the entire ad-free archives of the Wolf Den. Now, I admit, most of our episodes never really got ads in them anyway, but the ones that do are now ad-free too in Stitcher Premium. If you are a Howl subscriber, this is great news. With Stitcher Premium, you no longer have to switch apps to listen to the premium content. You can listen to the exclusive Howl shows you love in Stitcher alongside your favorite free podcasts. Your Howl account info, the things you kept track of, your favorites, your playlists, your listening history can be easily transferred over to Stitcher. So to learn more about Stitcher Premium, just go to StitcherPremium, that's one word, .com/WolfDen. Well, okay, I'm back with Aaron, and we are now going to switch and talk about his new show, Stoner. And I guess we were talking just before the break about the listener that you have in mind when you make shows. So who is the listener for Stoner?
That's a really good question. And part of answering that question is thinking about who likes weed in America right now.
Who doesn't like weed in America?
Well, I think like a good portion of America clearly has tried weed. I mean, all the numbers would say that. And I think there's also a lot of people who might have smoked weed in college and maybe don't now. You move somewhere and then maybe you're living in LA or Portland. It becomes legal and you're kind of curious. You're like, Oh, it's legal now. Maybe I want to give that a shot again, but I don't really know what I'm doing.
Right. Also, maybe not what I did sophomore year.
Yeah. And also I have like a job now and maybe I have kids now and my life is really different. So I think the answer is a greater and greater variety of people in America are trying and enjoying weed. And I want to create a show that has a sense of community amongst them. So my ideal listener is someone who has some interest and curiosity in marijuana and is also interested in the other people and their experiences and, you know, generally like who's out there. The show's more cultural than anything else. Like I'm also interested in sort of the evolving idea of stoner culture. And
yeah, well,
movies,
I was going to ask you,
entertainment.
What is stoner culture? How would you define it? Because it seems to be pretty open.
I think it is pretty open. I think about it in the sense of, okay, we have a country where drinking drives a huge amount of commerce, and even something like going to a concert is primarily actually a way to lure you to a place where beer is sold and sell you said beer. And if you imagine a country, and this is a real trajectory in America, that more and more people are considering maybe not having drinking as much and maybe trying marijuana.
It's actually happening statistically, I believe.
It's happening statistically, and it's happening very quickly in places where there's legal weed. And I think you start seeing a different kind of a concert, or you see people gravitating towards different kinds of TV and movies that have some sort of a harmony with those things. So I'd say stoner culture is kind of anything, could be anything that falls amongst that. Mm-hmm. And I'm more interested in bringing in people who do things that maybe are recognized in some way in that way, and then be like, well, what do you think? And what have your experiences been like?
You're trying to find out if the creativity is being driven by or in some way influenced by their smoking habits. Basically.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested. Like a lot of the shows I do, and I think a really common format is kind of like, how do you do it? And, you know, that's what we ask on the long form podcast is like, you make articles, how do you do it? Here I'm kind of asking like, you're an architect or you're a filmmaker or you run a graphic design studio and you also smoke weed. How do you do it? Like, what's your style like? What do you think it contributes or detracts?
So what have you heard? I'm curious about what – I mean, I've listened to a couple of the episodes, but what do you – What are the surprising things you've learned about how marijuana contributes to people's lives?
Well, I think people's preconceived notions from sort of the area they live in and their childhood really have a strong interaction with it. So like last week I had on a Chilean filmmaker, a guy named Sebastian Silva, and he was like, look, man, this is not a big deal in Chile. Like,
yeah.
Like I just smoked weed growing up, like all the kids did.
In a way, that's a terrible answer, though, because if there's no drama around it, then you don't have a story.
Right. But then you talked to the one I have going up today is with these two women in Atlanta who run this thing, zine called Dope Girl Zine. And they're like, look.
That
like,
should be a podcast.
Like smoking weed as a woman in Atlanta is really like frowned upon. Like, you know, it's considered like if you're like a boy and you like you want to go to a strip club, you smoke a joint at it, like fine. But like you're not marriage material.
Oh, it's like cigarettes 100 years ago.
Yeah. So all of these are, you know, different people living in America in 2017 having kind of different experiences. It's been really interesting just to talk to people, like talk to women, talk to people of color about how different the experience of being a marijuana enthusiast is based on who you are in America and where you live. Where you live is a big deal.
How old were you when you first tried pot?
Like probably 14, 13.
Yeah. What made you do it?
Cool kids.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Cool kids in a concert made me do it. Yeah.
And have you had an experience over time that's changed in your relationship to the drug?
Yeah, I mean, I think I've become kind of more insular probably. I spend a lot of time just sort of working on my own projects, so I'm not like out like partying, smoking weed. I'm like in my studio, mm-hmm. you know? And I've become, I think it's become more introspective experience for me over time.
Should we even call it a drug? I mean, I just did sort of reflexively.
I think that, I mean, I think it's fine to call it a drug, but cigarettes are also a drug.
Right.
And certainly drinking is a drug.
Right, but we don't, in conversation, you never hear people, or rarely hear people say that, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think they're all vices, honestly. And yeah. I think you should, like, kind of choose your vices wisely. Uh-huh. For me, like, the vice of, like, alcohol would not be a good one to choose, you know? Not that I, like, ever had, like, a drinking problem.
Right.
I just, like, sort of, like, project. Like, oh, I got to live another 40 years here. Like, I don't think I should probably, like, drink a lot during
right.
most of them, you know?
You may need both of those kidneys and
yeah.
the liver.
Yeah, and I later. Probably would, you know, I'd like to probably smoke less, too. I don't think it's, like, great for me. I mean, I don't try to make the show, like, weed is great. Like,
yeah.
And that can be a problem, I think, of a lot of the things that compete with it. It's a lot of advocacy, and there's a lot of kind of, like, well, don't say anything negative. Like, we don't want to set the movement back. But it's like, yeah, people have problems with weed, too. I've talked to people who have, you know, addictive problems
right.
with it. And I you could probably say that I'm addicted to weed on some level. So I just want to talk about those things.
Right.
I mean, I think if you're living in some suburb and you haven't smoked weed in 10 years and you want to get back into it and you don't know anyone who smokes any weed, it's hard
daunting.
To know anything. Yeah. It's,
right.
It's like, I don't know, you go on Reddit? I don't know.
Yeah, probably you could go on Reddit, but that's probably a different show.
Different vibe.
Different vibe. So how do you make this – it's too new to be financially determined how it's going to turn out, right?
Yep.
But how do you find sponsors for a thing like this?
I just talk to people. I mean, I've met a few publicists, and like often like the same people like are publicists for like the businesses and the personalities, mm-hmm. kind of like there's a lot of overlap and everything. Because I end up having people who work in the legal weed economy on the show just because it's hard to get people who are willing to be open about smoking weed and sort of out themselves. And that's a big issue we
really?
Talk about on the show is being out or not. You know, there's a lot of people who smoke weed daily, but people in their family don't know that.
Right.
You know, so.
Are you trying to sort of also take the veneer of shame off of this? Is that part of the mission of the show?
Yeah, I think so. Or at least to talk about the shame. I mean, look, I'm not saying like get out of the closet. If you feel like smoking weed and people not knowing is better for you, that's, I think, a totally valid choice.
Right.
But I think maybe hearing from people who are more out about what their experiences are is always going to be valuable. So in terms of getting sponsors, I'll just sort of put the word out, and we've gotten a few nice responses already. And I'm just sort of confident if you do really good stuff, it kind of like boomerangs back to you eventually. So
right.
my audience now is small enough that it wouldn't be like a ton of money. It's growing really rapidly. I mean, it's actually –
just say, like the weed itself.
Yeah, I feel like it's probably growing faster than the long form podcast grew. But I kind of know from doing long form podcasts that the payoff is on the deep end of the pool, not
That's
the
right.
shallow end of the
it's
pool.
It's on keeping those listeners, right? Yep. And so how do you market the show? How do you tell people that it exists? Because there are 10,000 podcasts a day.
Again, I don't have any really like great ideas about it. I did a few promos on long form podcasts, so it's nice. And I try to have people on the show who do podcasts and have like a podcast audience. Like my first guest was not accidentally Amina, who does Call Your Girlfriend.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, I saw a few people looked at my list and they're like, well, that person's way more famous. I was like, not to people who listen to podcasts.
Right.
It's like she's famous
group.
To yeah. And so
the Wolf Den bump is gonna be huge, by the way.
I'm planning to ride that wave. but yeah, and I think I also said that for the month it came out, I would appear on any podcast. So I got some takers. I appeared on some podcast that I don't even remember. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure I ever even received a link after being a guest on them. But that's sort of how I do it. I just like I'll do anything. I'm doing. Someone's writing a profile of me for like Mary Jane, which is a weed site, and you know I'll say yes to basically anything. I want people to know about.
What category is Stoner in iTunes?
You know, I'm wondering which I actually chose. I was kind of torn. I think I was choosing between
clearly.
Like entertainment and society and culture.
Uh-huh.
Probably I think I went society and culture. Yeah, because I think it's not really designed to entertain people as much as sort of talk culturally.
Right. And do you have a competitor? What's the show that you're trying to breathe down the neck of or that they're chasing you?
You know, I glanced over it and I didn't see anything that
That's
appealed to me.
That's a very stoner response to that question.
Yeah, I kind of let it go. I think there's more competition in among websites that are maybe covering similar topics, but and also like some of these kind of like online head shops kind of have like blogs now. That's probably some of my competition.
And your audience, do you know, getting into the analytics of all this a little bit, do you know mostly where they are? And
ironically, New York is still number one, which makes me think I haven't really tapped the LA market yet because I think LA should be my biggest one. But it's New York, California, and then like Oregon and Washington, which are legalization states, are pretty big, Chicago. But nothing like shocking in there,
right?
You know, kind of evenly spread around.
And this show is entirely yours. It's not part of longform.org.
No,
anyway, just
no.
A thing you're doing.
I mean, you know, we try to keep things really informal. Like, I share the same office with Pineapple, you know, and Longform Tapes in that same studio.
It's
and
podcasting,
it's like,
one big happy family.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, you know, they're doing their thing. Like, I'm doing this thing. We do long form still. Like, I'm hoping in a year we're doing, like, two more things, you know. My firm belief is in, like, not deferring or not trying to, like, plan too much around this kind of stuff. Like, I think particularly with my vision of podcasting, it's all about being, like, relentless and kind of, like, you know, I said Max really enforced on me when we were doing long form, like, let's do it for a year before we even consider – whether we're going to keep doing it or not.
Right.
And so I'm trying to take that approach here too. It's just like, all I need to do is get good guests, do good shows, and keep doing it.
What's your approach to ending things? How do you decide when I've spent enough time on this?
I'm terrible. That's a very blind spot for me. I'm
really?
Very bad at ending things, yeah.
Yeah. So do you have you trained yourself to force yourself to look at something once a year and just say, I shouldn't do this anymore? Or what?
Yeah,
you...
we have like we kind of have very informal, infrequent meetings with long form. And
which you dread, clearly,
yes,
just by the way your body
and usually we have to like talk about, like we have to say, oh, we really ought to end this like three times before we actually end it. And then we get a near, like, weirdly, like the app got rejected by Apple after, you know, being in the store for many years.
Yeah.
And I was kind of like, I think this is a sign that we're supposed to stop doing this.
Speaking of Apple, how do you feel about the news that they're going to be releasing analytics to all of us?
I have always been sort of shocked at the whole approach to like analytics and CPMs and the entire media industry.
Really?
Just how funny money it is and how.
What do you mean by that?
Well, like, okay, when I first started becoming interested in long-form journalism, I realized that, like, circulation rates count, like, 2.2 readers per magazine, which is just, like, where did this convention come from?
Yeah.
Because, like, it's, like, you put it on your, like, coffee table and someone else reads it.
It was
your
dentist office, I believe.
Yeah. You know, and then we did long form, and it's like people would be like, what's your traffic? Who are sponsoring? And we kind of, like, look, and it's like we have two different analytics suites. We have, like, Google Analytics and Clicky. And it's like, oh, the Clicky number is higher. So Let's report that one. And it's like, okay, so now we have like Libsyn, you know, Libsyn hosts Longform and hosts Stoner and a bunch of our shows. And it's like, so I know what our Libsyn number is, you know. When Apple comes out with their number, I'm guessing it's probably going to be smaller than the Libsyn number. I don't see – it would be very strange if it was bigger than the Libsyn number. That would confuse me.
That would be other hosting that you're not aware of,
So it's like, okay, it's just some – to me, it's just some – probably a multiplier. That's what I'm guessing is like, you know, that Libsyn – you know, Apple is 0.75 times Libsyn, and – I still think people are going to get the same value they're getting before because that was the value or they were getting before. Nothing changed. You just sort of put a different multiplier on it. Now, what may happen will be that different people have different multipliers, and that would be an interesting thing to learn. I am curious, does This American Life, which has been in the store forever and has millions of listeners, like how many – what is their percentage that are ghosts that don't actually ever like listen versus – me, which is a slightly newer show, versus a show like Stoner that's very new, which might not have hardly any ghosts because people have just subscribed to it. So I'm curious how all this stuff will work, but I haven't – what's the argument for like that it's going to be profound?
I don't know. We've talked about it a lot in the office, and I think we've come to the same conclusion that you have, that it's going to – it may be a different number, but you're not substituting a different audience. And if the advertisers – still get the results that they're looking for from the show, then the numbers are just kind of relative changes and not essential.
It kind of reminds me of like Bitcoin and the dollar, like they're like flying up and down relative to each other, but they're both like made up, you know?
To me, the interesting thing is really what will it tell us about the way people listen? How far in do they go? What is the, you know, it might be kind of crushing to learn that the Wolf Den people get about 15 seconds in and then it's like, oh, I think I'll try something else.
Well, okay, but this is my argument here, which is like I did this for an app. You know, we built the craziest analytics where I was like, I can tell you exactly how many words each person read and like these are the most read. And it's like, everything's kind of the same. Like abandon rates are probably similar across different podcasts. Like we built so many hooks that we were like, do people in Dubai like read more articles than people in Rome? And it was just kind of like all the data was kind of like, huh, kind of interesting. Yeah. I guess it's none of it's super counterintuitive. That's my guess is that it's like it looks like what you have. But it's like got a slightly different grid behind it.
And we'll just adjust to it. Does the fact that you'll be able to see how long people listen through on the long form podcast, are you at all worried that an hour and a half show sometimes or an hour and 15 minute show, that people are only really sticking around for 20? Would it influence what you decide to do about the shape of the show?
Absolutely not. in fact, you know, we've been doing 250 episodes. Like sometimes I'll have on a person who does some pretty like obscure, weird shit. Yeah. You know, like I had on Venkatesh Rao. He's like a gonzo economist. And I know that show is not for everyone. So I could be like, oh God, like what about people who have no interest in that? And they just want mainstream journalists. And it's like, no, just don't listen to that episode. If this episode doesn't interest you, don't listen to it. Mm-hmm. If you start listening to it for 5 or 10 minutes and you want to abandon it, please do. Like, that's great. Like that gives me the freedom to do a 90-minute interview with a gonzo economist because I'm like, I know that the people who are there for the last 30 minutes are interested in it. So I've never had a problem with going long. And I think that some people like cut interviews really short for that reason. And like I think people who come to our show are looking like we want to do the definitive
interview.
Long is
in the title.
Long's in the title. And I'm also like, is this maybe the only interview this person's going to do that sort of, you know, we have like Seymour Hersh. Right. On our store, and I'm like, this is probably the last time Seymour Hersh is going on a podcast, you know? Like, I'm not going to, like, edit this for the person who doesn't know who Seymour Hersh is and doesn't care and is like, who is this guy? I'm going to edit it for the person who's, like, a real, like, journalism buff.
Well, that's a great definition of who your audience is.
Yeah.
Is there something you wish Apple would give you information-wise about your audience or that all podcasters, we have a platform, Stitcher, that we should be thinking about giving you, the producer, or the host?
Well, I don't know. This stuff is like always, it always requires like two jumps forward instead of one jump forward, which is like, I would be very interested in knowing who else listens to my show, like what the sweet spot of other shows to my show is. And I've seen, you can see like a little recommend, but it's not really that in an analytic way. And then I think that the most effective way to market and move audiences in podcasts is probably from one podcast to another. And so I do wish there was more tools so that I could look at a podcast and say, like, I look at a podcast like Call Your Girlfriend, mm-hmm. and I say, both of these women smoke weed and have talked about it on the show. They have a great giant audience. All I really want is to get the women who smoke weed in that show to know that I have a show called Stoner that might be interesting to them and has had their host on it. I wish there was a way where I could make an exchange. Now, my show is too small, so we have a parody problem. But I have a show called Longform that's got some good good inventory to trade.
Right.
I wish there was more of an exchange internally of attention to where you could send your show to another show and they could send them to you, and it wasn't a buy an ad. It was somehow facilitated within the system.
It's funny. We actually do that with Gimlet and a few other networks, in which I think it's partly that there's a trust that we all have room to grow. Mm-hmm. And so it's okay to do that. I can't imagine network television ever doing that.
Yep.
But we still have tens of millions of people to acquire into this medium. So it's not a zero-sum game for us. And you can choose to listen whenever you want. It's not like 6 o'clock is my time or your time.
Yeah, I think that the enemy is most of the people in the world who don't know how to use a podcast player. They're not the enemy. That's the enemy of growth.
Oh, they're the enemy, all right.
Those people have to be stopped.
Yeah.
Those are the people that we're looking to convert. And that's something like Stoner is like, for a lot of people, might be their first podcast, because I've had people who are like, I'm curious about that. How do I
download? I'm stoned. What do I listen to?
Yeah, and so like that's the people I'm thinking about, and I'd love to be able to trade with. We've done trades like that also with other shows, but it's like it's almost like we have to run into someone at like a cocktail party and pitch it, and it can be a weird pitch. Also, it is actually a great deal, but it has that weird air of like, all right, you give me $5, okay? Here's $10. Now I'm gonna give you back the $5, and it's like, you know, especially if the shows are a different size. I always just feel like, well, it's like if you have a show that's like 30,000 listeners. Can you trade like 10 spots with someone to get one spot on a 200,000?
Then it gets too complicated. I think you want to make it as long as this industry is the size it is, you want to make this easy for everyone to do, because we don't have enough people to manage all those processes.
Right.
Right.
Until we put them on the blockchain.
Well, exactly. Let me ask you a little bit about music before we go.
Sure.
I'm curious about how you find time to make music and what's the great pleasure that, I mean, we all make music, many of us do anyway, but what's the specific pleasure that you get out of doing that and using that part of your brain?
Time. Well, I'm actually doing other show work for clients right now also, so I'm currently contending with whether I actually do have enough time to do the things that I have previously agreed to do. And I'd never done a weekly show before, and listening, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, I don't know. How was the ramp up for you?
Well, fortunately, this show has such an erratic production schedule that I don't have to worry about it so much.
Right. Okay. So, yeah, because, you tape it for weekly use, but you don't tape it on a weekly
schedule.
We have
such low expectations for ourselves that, yeah.
So that's the answer to that. Music is very different for me. I do it in more of an intensive, very short bursts a few times a year. So I'll go and work with Francis on writing songs, and we'll often go to a cabin or go to his place in LA, and I'll work in a really concerted way for a week or two at a time. So it's kind of like, even though it's a really big deal to me, it's something I do like 6 or 8 weeks out of the year really intensively. Mm-hmm. This year we went on tour, and we were opening for Chance the Rapper 2 months and September and October, and I tour managed that tour and did the playback. So during that period,
crazy.
Yeah, that was a little crazy. And we were still doing like long form podcasts and stuff, like interviewed AJ Delario from like a stop on their tour bus, I think. but normally I don't have those kind of responsibilities, so I can kind of mix and match. And what I do really like to do in my day to day life is just kind of like, I have a little studio in my basement, and it's like where I record podcasts, and it's also where I have some very minimal audio gear. And I'm like a very amateur musician. Like, I don't play an instrument. I don't really know.
You just happened to tour with Chance the Rapper. I understand.
Well, I happened to have met someone really talented when I was like a teenager, and we have a working partnership. And I'd say the same thing about podcasts. I happened to meet someone very talented named Max Linsky, and now we have a podcast together, and he got me into it. So it's a similar thing I approach as an amateur, but it's a really different part of the brain. So I do like to at night kind of like, I will watch a movie, then like kind of go back down there and have like another day from like 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. or so.
That's just your music.
Yeah. And it's like a very different, like I don't talk to anyone and I like kind of know like the end of it is when I just like start falling asleep.
Do the making of the two things, podcast and music, have anything in common?
I think they really do, actually. I was talking to a music producer I know, like a really famous like pop hit maker who wanted to do a show. So I was kind of talking to him about his, you know, ideas for the show he wanted to do. Because you know that like Apple Music and stuff, people are like going to music. People want to create these kind of serious Apple Music kind of shows. So like if you're a big person in music, you've probably been contacted by Spotify or someone who wants you to do a show. And I think the similarity is that, you know, modern production and music making is a very collaborative social experience. And being able to sit there and have a sort of semi-improvisational conversation with someone that is supposed to produce like cool ideas, I think that's a skill. And I think that's what like a lot of good producers do. They sort of are interviewing the artist about what they want over time. And that's kind of where I see the overlap. And I do think like musicians are interesting to talk. Like a lot of musicians, I think, don't want to talk literally about music. But if you force them to, you can go really interesting places.
Right. I saw that same reluctance. I worked on a show called Soundcheck from WNYC.
Oh, yeah.
Many, many musicians came through there. They often were the most difficult interviews.
Yes.
To get them to say anything articulate about what they actually do all day.
And so I have a lot of musicians on Stoner as guests. And in many ways, you could say that Stoner is not actually about weed. I actually don't care that much about weed. Like, I'm not like some dude who's like
you heard
obsessed
it here first.
With weed.
Yeah.
I think it's an interesting entry point into a lot of things right now. When I ask you something like, when was the first time you smoked weed? I'm asking you, where are you from? What were you like as a teenager? How did you go from that person to the person you are now?
Mm-hmm.
And that can get someone talking in a way that's like, hey, what's your new record all about? Is not going to get someone talking.
Right. Well, I hope I asked you the right questions today. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much. This is great.
Aaron Lammer is the co-founder of Longform.org and the co-host of the Longform podcast, and most recently the host of a brand new podcast called Stoner. Where can we find you on online and social media and things like that?
I'm just Aaron Lammer on Twitter. That's kind of like the most reliable place. You can go to francisandthelights.com. We have a new video with Chance the Rapper in it, actually, for a song called May I Have This Dance. And Longform's at longform.org. And Stoner is – this is a problem I have.
Yeah.
How do you tell people where to go for a podcast? Might give the address of the website. The website just has the podcast.
Well,
on
so
it.
My closing line is subscribe to The Wolf Den at earwolf.com, Stitcher, or Apple Podcasts, and please rate the show on iTunes. That's what I say at the end of the
exactly
show.
Exactly the same statement, but for Stoner. It's in all of those places, and please subscribe.
That works for me. Thank you. Thanks very much to Harry Nelson and Jared O'Connell, who helped me make the show. And good luck, Lex, wherever you are in your yacht.
Hi, I'm Matt Gourley, and on my show, I Was There Too, I interview actors who are on set for some of the greatest films ever made. You'll hear stories from the sets of Star Wars.
There is a great disturbance in the Force.
The Shawshank Redemption.
It was singly the worst audition I ever gave.
And Back to the Future.
This isn't just a bullet cafe. Something bad is happening.
Subscribe to I Was There Too on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or your favorite podcast app. This has been an Earwolf production, executive produced by Scott Aukerman, Chris Bannon, and Colin Anderson. For more information and content, visit earwolf.com.
Want to hear Earwolf pilots before anybody else? We made a podcast feed just for you. Earwolf Presents is full of great stuff, like preview episodes for upcoming shows, peeks behind the paywall, and pilots for podcasts that haven't even been made yet. It's like getting to listen in behind the scenes here at Earwolf. Starting January 21st, Earwolf Presents will have a bunch of new pilots for you, like Edgar Montplaisir's The Wokest. Catch conversations between the wokest man in the world and comedians like Risa Lechea. Also, hear upcoming pilots The Florida Cast, Wow, You're Native American Too?, This Week in Sports, and Carl Alarm all throughout the month. Let us know what you think of them with hashtag Earwolf Presents. Subscribe to Earwolf Presents to hear more great episodes from around the network and behind the paywall, like an episode of Drew Tarver's Strictly Business with Derek Contrera, or Act One of Matt Besser's punk musical, Stolen Idea. Just search for Earwolf Presents in your podcast app and subscribe so you don't miss an update.